Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Today we're going to listen to a live forum show that was part of the Night of Ideas at the San Francisco Public Library on March 2nd. The theme for the night was fault lines, and we gathered a few of our favorite forum guests to talk about our spin on the theme, the hyphen that we sometimes use to bridge our identities, Japanese-American, Mexican-American. The gap between our named ancestry and our country of residence is a cultural fault line that helps define who many of us are. We talked about the complexities of racial and ethnic identity because we know fault lines aren't just dangerous. The energy they release is also productive. That's all coming up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal, and we're listening back to our live show from Night of Ideas. That's a big event at the San Francisco Public Library that brings together thinkers and artists, scientists and drag queens, and we brought some of our favorite Forum guests for a conversation about the hyphens we use to bridge our identities. I was joined by poet Mimi Tempest, author of the collection The Delicacy of Embracing Spirals, Christina Mora, associate professor in sociology at UC Berkeley, musician Kaoru Ishibashi, who performs under the name Kishibashi. His most recent work is Omoyari, which accompanies his song film of the same title, and writer Jonathan Escoffery, whose celebrated debut story collection, If I Survive You, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. I started by asking Jonathan just to read from the opening pages of his book.
It begins with, "What are you?" Hollered from the perimeter of your front yard when you're 9, younger probably. You'll be asked again throughout junior high and high school, then out in the world, in strip clubs, in food courts, over the phone, and at various menial jobs. The askers are expectant. They demand immediate gratification. Their question lifts you slightly off your pre-adolescent toes, tilting you, not just because you don't understand it, but because even if you did understand this question, you wouldn't yet have an answer. Perhaps it starts with, what language is your mother speaking? This might be the genesis, not because it comes first, but at least on this occasion, you have some context for the question when it arrives. You immediately resent this question. In this moment, for the first time, you are ashamed of your mother, and you are ashamed of yourself for not defending her. More than to be cowardly and disloyal, though, it's shameful to be foreign. If you've learned anything during your short residence on Earth, you've learned this. It's America, and it's the 80s, and at school, in class, you pledge to one and one flag only, the stars and stripes. Greatest country on earth is the morning anthem. It's the lesson plan, a mantra drilled into you day in, day out, a fact as inarguable as 2 + 2 = 4. And what you start to hear, as you repeat this to yourself, is the implication that all other nations, though other nations are seldom mentioned in school, are inferior. If you'd had any context for the question of what you are when it first arrived, you might have answered American.
Jonathan Escoffery reading from If I Survive You. John, I think like in the pantheon of questions that people are asked, what are you might be the most resented, most hated question out there. What do you think it is about that question that people hate so much?
I think it's This is a multi-pronged answer in a sense. I think the simpler one is just that you may be going about your day, right, concerned with making rent, concerned with getting to your job, just living in this body that you didn't necessarily ask for. you didn't. None of us did. But for someone to kind of snatch you and call you out of that moment where you're just living and demanding of you an answer. And then the second part of that is that it seems as though they already have a number of acceptable responses in mind, right? They're like, I bet he's either this or he's this, And if it's not one of those answers that the asker, already has decided, like that's an acceptable answer, then there's always this like, but
what are you really?
But what are you really? Yeah. Where are you really from? You're from here. And in Miami, for me to say American was never an acceptable answer. Mm-hmm. So it's like, but where are your parents from? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not what I imagine someone whose parents are from there to look like. So, but where are you really from then, yeah. And how do you explain that? Yeah. And so it's not even that the question is difficult. It's just a phenomenon more that beyond that. It goes beyond that. That's difficult.
Christina, I'm thinking about, these are ways that people outside are trying to get us to like define ourselves. A lot of your work is about how, people inside a particular community say like, no, call us this. And then some other people say, actually, maybe don't call us out, call us this. Walk us through a little bit, because a little bit of how these groups get made, Latinos or Hispanic or these other kind of big groups.
Yeah, I think of everything as a dance. So even if there are groups that feel that they want to express themselves and we are who we are based on our own terms, it's never really your own terms. It's always a response, right? It's a response to what society, to what the state, to what others think you are. So you have some autonomy and some agency. Latinos can say all of these things. We've built America. We were here before others. We are hard workers. We are this. But that narrative is still in response to what others actually really think real Americans are. So there is always a dance of what the group can say versus who others think you are. And it's because none of these conversations are ever made outside of power. Outside of real power relationships that have always characterized American history, right? And so who you are, what group, how big you can be, what you can imagine that you are, is always in that conversation of what others before you have always pegged you as. So when I think of Latinos, I think of all the amazing beauty and imagination that can come in that. I think of all the amazing heterogeneity. And I think even if we have our wildest dreams of who Latinos can be, there's always that ting of, but are you really American, right? That will always be something to answer to. So I've seen it historically as this back and forth, moments of resistance and sort of response.
And is it kind of similar, I had been learning recently about like the history of the term Asian American, which I didn't realize had the same kind of political valence as Chicano did, like even growing out of basically the same kind of Third World Liberation Front kind of movement building. When we're coming to these bigger boxes, are they usually driven by movements like that? Or are they, when you say imposed by the state, or is it the state says, okay, you can mark down this set of boxes?
Well, lots of groups don't have boxes, right? And so you think of Middle Eastern right now, in which there is no census designation for Middle Eastern. They're just white on that. And so there's this move to say, this is who we are, but where does that land? Is it this geographic or is this other geographic, right? I think for Chicanos, certainly there is a political awakening. There is the moment of the 1960s, the pushing back of like, no, we're not just white or we're not just others. We are this, and we have these visions of being united through racial domination and struggle, right? And so there's that movement. And you did see that. You see this like in the 1960s amongst Asian American, a move to say we're Asian American, that second part. We've got yellow power, we've got brown power. We don't want these oriental other sort of labels that you've emplaced on us. And so you do have those expressions full of music and poetry, political activism in which groups are trying to define themselves in these ways, they're always, always imperfect projects. Latinidad is an imperfect project, right? What does it really mean? What does it look like? What is that skin color? What is that political belief? It's imperfect, and yet at the same time, it's a project of resistance, too, where people are continuously defining it different over time.
Okay, let's come to you. I mean, your song film and the album associated with it, Omoyari, it kind of chronicles your journey to understand Japanese internment. I think a song you're going to play, sometimes it makes me cry. It's like about what immigrant parents sort of gain, what they lose, what they hope for their kids. Maybe you can set it up better than I can, though.
Oh, okay. Well, I think it's called Theme for Jerome, and it's about Jerome, which was a concentration camp in America for Japanese Americans during World War II. And I think what I started to discover was that many of them did not speak English at all. And they did their best to maintain culture, but their way out of the camps was really to just is to speak English and remove themselves of that culture. And a lot of that in the Japanese American population that emerged after the war do not speak Japanese. And to me, that was something that was especially painful and sorrowful. So this is a song about losing that language, which is, I'm sure, is something that we can all, if you're an immigrant or children of immigrants, you can relate to. So it starts with a melody. It could be a Japanese melody. After today, we speak the new with every word. From the comfort of my hand, 'cause after all, we fight this war with enemies unseen. 'Cause here we are in Jerome.
Listening back to our show from Night of Ideas at the San Francisco Public Library in early March about identity and culture with poet Mimi Tempest, Berkeley professor Christina Mora, writer Jonathan Escoffery, and musician Kishibashi, who you're listening to now. We'll be right back after a short break.
There was a girl. She fell in love. And on the sun dry lands, it settled in. Started again, and when they'd sleep, she'd sing this melody to her beloved sons, forgotten words from Japan.
At Star One Credit Union, they're all about building long-term relationships and helping your money grow by making banking effortlessly easy. It's why they offer real great rates on home, auto, and solar loans. Star One provides super simple, everyday banking solutions, including a stellar digital banking experience that puts you first. Become a member at starone.org or drop by any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Welcome back. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're listening to our live show from Night of Ideas in San Francisco about identity and culture. We'll rejoin with my question for poet Mimi Tempest. Mimi, do you want to chip in before we have you read some of your work? Do you want to chip on, like, you know, what feels familiar, what doesn't feel familiar in this categorization conversation around African-American versus some of these other categories we've been talking about?
What's consistent in all the threads of the answers and in the song, the beautiful song that Kishi just offered, is the cry for humanity. And for me, humanity is all about being seen, being heard, and being respected and acknowledged for being human. So more boxes, less boxes, you know, where you're from, outer space, on from the ocean, internment camp, Japan, diaspora, diasporic or not. I think what's consistent in all of our answers, and I would say in all of our art form and our academy and our theory and stuff like that, is the consciousness of what it means to be human and to speak towards others who may be different on what humanity is.
Why does it seem to be such a fraught and difficult thing? Like, when you put it like that, I'm like, yeah, totally. We should all just recognize each other's humanity. Problem solved, you know? Right. Like, why is it so hard?
Right. I mean, if we did that, a lot of things that are happening right now wouldn't be happening, correct? I mean, but it goes back to your answer. It's power, right? And power, the need for dominance and power comes from a lack mindset. I think it could be so simple as acknowledging all of our humanity, but we have to always be in question and be in contention with our understanding of power. You know, who am I in relations to power? Who is my community, whether it be Latino, Chicanx, whether it be African American, diasporic, Black, whatever it is, whatever box that you choose to check off, what is that relationship to power? And I think from that question, just that curiosity, that fundamental intellectual curiosity of what is my or what is our understanding to power, everything else gets to become dismantled, at least the process of thinking and creating through an opportunity or a relationship to liberation.
Do you want to read the work that we have picked out, or you picked out?
Most definitely. Yeah. Alexis was like, you can't read the naughty poems.
Don't read the sex one.
You can't say the bad words, Mimi. All right. This is Untitled Number 4 from my book, The Delicacy of Embracing Spirals, and this is on why the culture is never seen smiling. To those unborn who dare to pick up a pen, when you open your history books, look back on this year and ask where all our teeth went. Our answer is simple. It's not because love wasn't caressed into the seams in this current nightmare life silhouette. It's not because we failed to wake up every morning without you on our minds. It's not because we lived hell in a year and a year exposed 400 years of a failed human experiment. It's not because we didn't stitch every word to fulfill your prophecy. It's not because every word stitched prior didn't help us walk in our own. It's not because you weren't envisioned to inherit the heaven that is already ordained with you. It's our answer is simple. It's because our teeth were never here to begin with. Every utterance of this poem is a prayer in your name, and every prayer in your name is a possibility to fulfill a future that always existed through the alchemy of our designated tongues. Our prayer is simple. May there be less dead leaves withering during your fall. May your mind and body know rest. May wisdom reverberate from your lungs like air. May the words sing in your ears like honey. May you create and fulfill your own glory. May the streets you walk be clear and paved. May you make love and know it as the world's only gold. May each stanza bear themselves naked to you. May the chatter of their false ideations be heard as lull. May you try and fail and try again to succeed. May you succeed only on your own terms. May your pen write in the same cadence of your heart. May mother be behind your tongue always. May your heart feel no bounds. May the universe announce itself in your presence. May joy always whisper jewels from over your shoulder. May death be kinder to you than what she was to us. May your life experience no limits or frames or bombs or cages. May your lessons be learned hard and fast. May you forgive our mistakes and misunderstandings. May you forgive our mistakes and understandings. May you forgive our mistakes and understand and misunderstandings. May you pass your inheritance to the next generation. May time be your companion, not your cosmic overseer. And may every body not be a dead man's sonnet. And may every tear shed on a mother's cheek not be understood only as soliloquy. And may the laughter of a child be heard as grace in haiku. And when your words find refuge on the blank page, write like the gods are the ones reading your soul. Write as if you were revealing yourself as God too. Our answer and our prayer is simple. And you, brilliant one, you were always the answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mimi, who are you thinking about? Like, who did you want to write that poem for?
You know, it's interesting that you asked me that question. I wrote that poem to my future child, who I wish to have eventually in this lifetime. So that's where that softness, so much of my book is very hardcore, but that poem is the stakes, the stakes of the piece. Yeah.
Jonathan, I wanted to ask you about ancestors. I've been thinking a lot about ancestors, and it's interesting, like in our, you know, Bay Area queer worlds, you know, everyone's extending this idea of family out so much further in these beautiful ways. You know, family isn't just a couple of people with a couple of kids. It's like all these kinds of kin, right? Can we do that with ancestors also? Like, how do you see who your ancestors are? Not just maybe the people that are on your ancestry.com, but like your other kinds of ancestors.
That's an interesting question.
Like, do you have Miami ancestors? People who were like, that person did Miami in a way that I think is interesting.
Or I get what you're saying. I mean, I definitely do. I've got lots of influences in terms of, so my book, it's about, I guess to boil it down, I could say one way to identify the characters is that it's about Jamaican Americans, in a sense, in Miami, in South Florida in particular, and who I'd read about a little bit in terms of not just Jamaican authors, but Jamaican authors who had emigrated themselves and were writing about that experience in the U.S. It had more of a New York bent. And so thinking about that kind of South Florida, South Florida is such a, Miami in particular, and you know, the various neighborhoods in Miami are so, you know, kind of strange and unique in the way that, you know, lots of places can be unique, and including here in the Bay. But Janine Capel-Crusette wrote a book called How to Leave Hialeah. Hialeah is it's its own incorporated city, but it's, you know, it's under that kind of 305 Miami umbrella in a way, but it's the kind of place where, you know, you're and it's mentioned in the book, you know, your stop signs say alto, you know, they don't say stop first, they say alto first. She did Miami with such justice, but she also had characters who were concerned with this issue of wanting to leave Miami and consider what that might be like and the difficulty of that. So many Harlem Renaissance authors, people, you know, I should say authors who are kind of associated with the Harlem Renaissance, including Jamaicans, Claude McKay, you know, I love his poetry and his fiction as well. I think Langston Hughes was kind of my first literary hero. I often credit the Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain, that essay of Langston Hughes's that kind of opened up my mind to the idea that wanting to just be, or holding an idea that I want to just be a great author, or just a great writer, and leave like blackness aside because I was scared to wind up on like a particular bookshelf that was gonna, you know, helm me in and not allow me to experience
or express all of my full humanity. And in that essay, it's such a beautiful explanation for why, if you want to express your full humanity as a Black person, like Blackness is a wonderful lens to do that. If you happen to be black, Blackness is a major part of your experience. It's a major part of mine. And so,
do you have like a problematic uncle character though, or something that you like? You know, do you like, you're like, man, Joseph Conrad, or you know, whatever. I don't know, somebody who's like completely outside of.
Oh yeah.
You know, but that you just love. You're like, man, I don't know. What can I say? You know.
Well, problematic. Dennis Johnson, is a literary, I don't know. Hero, godlike figure. I did an MFA. I did the like traditional writing, educational career path, and my mentor, in the sense of my grad school advisor, Charlie Baxter, who's also a wonderful writer, but he invited Dennis, yes, as he knew him to class, and had me interview him because Dennis Johnson wrote a lot about like. Jobs or gigs, and I was writing a lot about jobs and gigs. And when I say gigs, like the stuff you don't want to tell your parents about type of gigs in order to get money and survive. And met him, and honestly, I don't think he liked me very much. I didn't get a lot of eye contact there, but but his writing is so wonderful that it was kind of like there's no love lost. I mean, on my side. I'm sure there's more people.
Christina, let me ask you the ancestry question in a different way. I think there are some. You grew up in L.A., right?
Yeah.
There's some. Yeah, right. Like Pacoima. There's some parts. I mean, there's some parts of the Bay Area that are like this too, where Mexican American kind of is too big a category, right? You have to kind of have to go underneath it to even get like, all right, your parents are from what state and they came at what point and those things. Do you think that kind of smaller categorization, is it interesting? Is it like, what is it? What does it do for us to do that, go that way? Because it seems like a really natural impulse. People do it.
Well, let me think. So, Mimi's from LA too. So if you know LA, it's one of the most segregated cities in America. It's quite diverse and yet highly segregated, just like many other places in California. And so while 50% of LA County is Mexican or Latino more broadly, that those pockets are really relegated. One of those places is where I grew up, which is a place called Pacoima, which at one point had been highly African American and then transitioned into much more Latino. In fact, Barbara Lee was from the Pacoima area, went to the same high school. Okay, so by the time, yeah, just a little plug. So by the time I was at San Fernando High, we used to joke that diversity there was what state in Mexico your parents were from. And it was really like one of four states. So like, were you more northern, like Durango, or were you like me, like from Michoacan? And those are just migration patterns, right? Those migration patterns, there's so many people in California from Michoacan because that was an agricultural area in Mexico that had a train station where people got in. The train station was actually maybe 5 miles from where my grandfather raised my father, and my grandfather, when he was 20 years old, walked those 5 miles, got on the train, and became a bracero, and spent from about 20 to about close to 50 working the fields up and down California all the way up to Washington and back. Now, where did they live when they got here? They couldn't just live anywhere. There's racial segregation, there's labor market segregation, and there's real patterns of historical hostility, right? We know that there are racial covenants in California too, in Los Angeles. We know that there are sundown towns historically, even in LA County, parts of that, right? And so these places became very few areas where people could live, and through migration networks, my grandfather ended up leaving the agricultural areas because my father, who became a farm worker too, met someone who knew a factory work in Pacoima. And so they went, and he pulled his father, and they pulled their brother, and they pulled. And so this is how sort of these areas grow. And as I remember, you know, I was born in 1980, so I remember growing up in L.A. in the 80s, and just it's almost like on every other block in Pacoima, my parents knew someone. And it was someone from the hometown, and it was someone that also worked in the factories, and it was someone that also needed help, and it was someone who had just come, and it was three families in a home. And you sort of knew. And what's interesting is these kinds of neighborhoods where you felt, you know, a deep tie, like, you know, I tell everybody I'm from Pacoima, I find a deep tie to these areas. It's because these are areas of commonality, yet these are also areas where the commonality is formed because of segregation, because of deep inequalities, because of deep restrictions on where people could live. So it's these types of areas that are beautiful, that we hold these ties to, these, the way I think about these immigrant communities, these enclaves, they could be like Hialeah, they could be like, you know, East Oakland, they could be like any of these areas, but they're formed in these, you know, nuanced histories of, you know, these migrant ties, you know, forged out of these power relations and, you know, often lots of violence and lots of inequalities,
Kay, is there a big split in the Japanese American community between people who were like here before incarceration, so therefore have that experience of the U.S. state coming in doing those things, and people who came later, like yourself?
Yeah, so my film and my album was about the Japanese-American incarceration, and like you said, that's something that I have no familial connection to, because my parents came after the war, and I think when I was doing research and working on this film, I learned that they called, you know, Nisei is the term for second generation, Nisei, you know, and that's what I always thought I was until I realized that that community calls me Shin Nisei, which is like new Japanese American, you know, and it's like a label I learned recently, like a few years ago. And I think it's the kind of thing where a lot of that generation, you know, and their descendants, their identity is based a lot in this incarceration, assimilation, and subsequent, you know, this new culture of on the West Coast and in Chicago and various pockets that they emigrated to. But my culture is based on, like, directly to Japan, you know. And so I have this, like, you know, I think now I think they're forming a new kind of identity, which is Japanese American, which is all, you know, which is to include all the diasporas, you know, like my mom's Okinawan, and my Japanese, kind of. Japan, you know, conquered Okinawa, and so Okinawa has this unique culture that they kind of made them lose their language and do all these awful things to them during the World War. But anyways, I think it's a very complicated thing, but it's also a good time to start talking about this nuance, and I think people are more and more accepting of this new sophisticated notion of being a minority in this country.
We are listening back to our live show from the Night of Ideas in San Francisco about the hyphens, you know, Arab American, African American, that bridge our identities, with poet Mimi Tempest, UC Berkeley sociologist Christina Mora, writer Jonathan Escoffery, and musician Kishibashi. We'll be right back after a short break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
I'm Alexis Madrigal with more from our forum show from Night of Ideas at the San Francisco Public Library earlier this month. We'll start back with a question from the audience.
A question for Christina. How does disability influence the formation of those identities, especially when the question becomes not what are you, but what's wrong with you?
Yeah. You know, identity is so complex. We've been talking about boxes that you check. That's identification. Identity is so multi-layered, so intersectional, so much a part of not only your race or ethnicity or migration, but also your sexuality and all other parts of your embodiment, right? The sort of idea of the body and ability, I think it's its own construction of identity. And I think the way that you've phrased it of not just sort of what is ableism, right, and what are disability rights, an important part of this, that itself is a sense of an identity that was constructed as well, right? It was often so long ago relegated or invisibilized, right? And it wasn't until we started collecting data, there were social movements that argued for the importance of collecting data so that we could track the inequalities in the labor market and education and everywhere else and get this data and then advocate for more resources and more social rights. So I see that as a process itself. I see that when those processes that happen for political activism and advocating in that way, they're imperfect projects, right? Then the question becomes, what is the boundaries of the identity? Does it include sort of only physical limitations? Does it include mental limitations? What does that mean? And then you get into those sticky political questions, right? And these are imperfect projects, but I think at the end of the day, they are about shifting the way we think of who can be included, right? And what does inclusivity mean? And so I see that as sort of a constructed part, and yet I see also identity as multi-layered in all of these ways. And, you know, at different points in time, there might be one identity that we're most activated or close to or thinking about more, but they're all part of our sort of complex ways that we identify with.
Yeah. You know, Mimi, I know that one of your great literary ancestors is Wanda Coleman, Los Angeles poet. And I kind of want you to think about like then and now, especially given we're talking about a time that we've had many different social movements. We've had many different, you know, invisibilities made visible. We've had many different like bits of progress and, you know, and things go wrong and things pull back. And do you think it's the same? Do you think you and Wanda Coleman are more or less encountering the same world? Like, is that what you find in her work that you're like, oh my God, this is still, despite all these things, it's still fundamentally the same world I'm encountering?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And Christina, first off, Christina, my grandfather's from Michoacan as well.
Oh my God.
And my dad went to San Fernando High School. But
yes,
so are we cousins?
We were talking about this, yes.
But a lot of what Christina was mentioning is also prevalent in a lot of Wanda's work. So Wanda is, you know, when you think of Los Angeles, most people think Hollywood, they think glitz, they think glamour, they think the facade that the entertainment industry has presented to the world as Los Angeles. But there is an underbelly of racism, segregation, classism, elitism, and violence, specifically police brutality. And Wanda, I would say for me and a lot of other Los Angeles poets, we're not, you know, she's not the first of her kind, but neither am I, is the forebearer or the foremother of doing the work to bring the world the consciousness of the realities that are happening in Los Angeles. So I don't see, I mean, one can say, yes, these are two worlds, whether Wanda's writing in the 70s and me writing in a contemporary sense, that Los Angeles is the same. It's just that the Leviathan of the violence and the power structures of
Los Angeles has shifted, and how Wanda wrote about it is true to her voice and her time, and she's in a sense passed on the torch for me to read. Let me show you a new vision, a new film, a new Hollywood film of how this is happening. But it's just it's the same monster with a different face. You know, all Satan did was go back into the mirror and change how he presented himself, but the power structures and the violences are still consistent, and it's our job to just keep on raising that awareness of what's happening.
Let's take another question. I think we got one right there. Sorry. Yeah.
First, hello. Second of all, I grew up in Virginia. I see you, Kishibashi. And I was born and raised as an Egyptian American. And my whole life, those checkboxes that you speak of, there never was a Middle Eastern checkbox, right? So I always thought of it as, okay, maybe I'm African-American. So I always checkboxed African-American. It wasn't until 4 years ago when I was doing the census where there was actually a designation where it was white, not of Hispanic origin. And next to that said Egyptian, Syrian, you know, that all that. But when I go to Egypt, I'm considered an American, and my white friends will not say I'm white, and my black friends will not say I'm black. So what is your opinion on that designation of white, not of Hispanic origin?
Mm.
Is that a question for me?
It's for the professor.
You know, those examples are, you know, culminations of decades of debate. And what is this, like, there is no science. Race is not biological. It is not genetic. Geography and all human times, people have moved. National boundaries change. By what measures should we create these boxes? This is much, much more of a social question, and society is messy. We marry each other, we look different, we change our identities, we change our hair, all of these things, right? And so creating perfect maps, perfect categories, perfect boxes is an imperfect project. And yet, if we are to have sort of be able to track the inequalities, be able to understand the repercussions of profound racial power and differences, there's a way in which we must, right? The Middle Eastern category in many ways, you know, it's actually Middle Eastern, North African, right? And then the what part of Africa became a big question, right? This is at least, you know, 15 years of debate, and not all academics, you know, there is wide variety of perspectives. There's not one answer in the academy of where the North African starts or what is Middle Eastern. Is it also Israel? Is it also, you know, how far into Central Asia? Even if you think of Asian American, South Asians used to be just white, right? It wasn't until, I think, 1970 and then 1980 for sure that South Asian got taken out of white category and into Asian American category, and then you had Pacific Islander taken out. All of that to say is this has changed dramatically over time. It has changed as common understanding has changed, and you know, now today the state says, we're not gonna tell you who you are. You tell us who you are. You check your boxes, right?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Sorry, Alexis. This is just out of my own curiosity. What do you think the original motive behind creating these ethnic, you know, polling for
slavery and voting?
So it started as just voting rights. Black and white.
And back then it was called the Indian. Yeah. So counting who was free, who could vote, and what would be given, you know, who was fully human, who was three-fifths of a human, right? You needed to sort of say, what is the white free population? What is the other population? The other population then would be black or would be Indian?
I take this question to a higher, just a higher frequency, just slightly. If you didn't have those categorizations, right, who are you as a human being? I think that question is a lot more interesting than the I guess the consistency of needing to define what an identity is. I mean, it's important, most definitely. I don't want to erase that because there's a lot of cultural significance to these these definitions. But I think, I mean, does that dictate how you live your life and how happy you are?
And who you marry,
and what you pass down to your future potential children? I don't know. I mean, yes and no to those questions.
It's funny because I actually was going to send this question kind of to you, imagining you were going to spike it in my face, which is like, we're talking about all these different ethnic and racial categorizations, and people can go, you know, tinier and tinier slices of things and make sure they're exactly represented in the way that they want. And yet, you know, doing this show over the years, we go super deep into, you know, this Korean-American experience over here and this Vietnamese refugee experience over there and East African community strife over here. And through everyone, I'm just kind of like, it's not that I think I'm having exactly that experience or I understand all of it, but there's a core humanity to each of those things that I feel like I'm like, am I just a dupe for universalism? Like, am I just like, this is so great. I actually do understand what you're saying as a human. And I'm also a human. Like, this totally works.
But I think the trouble of consistent or the need of consistent categorization is that's the function of the system itself, to create these dialogues within the self and within the culture to constantly question, well, who do I fit in with and who am I and how do I do it? It becomes a spiral in which no one is able to really live. I guess I'm curious on the importance of it, but also the function of it, and then the happening of it simultaneously. And at what point do you, as the human being, decide, well, am I going to spend my entire day defining and categorizing, or am I just going to smile and enjoy
let me bring Jonathan for 1 second on this one, because one thing that's interesting to the question of does it change the way you live your life, when you have gone different places outside of South Florida, you've actually had your category change that way that people were perceiving you.
Yeah. I think in a sense.
Or at least the character in your book has had that.
Yeah.
The character who's most definitely not Jonathan Escoffrey in the book, If I Survive
not
You,
Jonathan has had
that things change.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is, if you live in a place like Miami, when I say a place like Miami, in part I'm talking about, one of the United States, there are more people born not in the United States in Miami than in the United States in Miami. And so a place like that, you have racial categorizations being imported from elsewhere, so to speak. So some of that, like if I had a dollar for every time I was like referred to as mulatto, in Miami.
Like, you said what?
Yeah, I'm like, excuse me, pardon me? And not necessarily to say, you know, I always took it as I would like to understand more where this is coming from, and then to go to a place a place like Minnesota where I went for grad school, where one, I would not be categorized in that way, and a word that clearly is problematic, but at the same time, in a place like Miami, there's room for people to want to understand the nuances at the same time of who you are. But I think, for me, it's kind of like human beings, I have a lot of faith in on one hand, and on the other hand, I think we're very simple. We can't handle all of the nuances, or we've proven ourselves to not be able to decide to choose to want to know all of the nuances of people outside of our own selves, like our own human experience. And so there's this kind of wanting to boil others down who we encounter two very simple categories. So I think beyond the, in a contemporary sense of, beyond that power structure of coming from slavery and all of that, I think there's a kind of both, if I can categorize you as this, I know you as friend or foe. And if I can categorize myself in a way that's simple as well, then maybe I can very simply feel comfortable in a way. And I think, racial essentialism is, to me, is, I think a lot of people, including in my own communities, really believe in it, and I think I don't believe in it. I don't buy it, but I also understand that we're simple people who want simple answers.
We are running out of time, and so I want to hear a new song from Kishibashi. So, sorry, no more questions. Let's hear a song. You want to set it up at all? New album?
Sure. So It took me, you know, I made a documentary features on Paramount Plus. It took me 6 years to make, and a lot of these songs, I have a whole new album coming out this fall that's completely different. But one thing that's consistent is that I've been kind of like really integrating Japanese unapologetically like into my music, which is something I wouldn't have been able to do like 10 years ago when I started my career. Mm-hmm. So here's a new song, absolutely brand new, never performed it. I'm just going to hack through it if that's okay. This is a song called Chiba Funk. Chiba's like a suburb of Tokyo. It's kind of like Long Island or like New Jersey. Not the coolest place, but I do have some fond memories of it. So this one starts in Japanese. So if you don't understand, I'm so sorry. But I translated it for the second verse.
Kimi no koe ni oboretari, furi muita sono egao, mune no kizu o naosite mo kokoro no munazukai. I would long to see the sunny afternoon. My desire is taken after you. Put away those games of many solitudes. Can build an afterlife in you. Haru, to overtake the noonday sun. I wanted to overtake the noonday sun. Kimi no koe ni oboretari, furi muita sono egao, mune no kizu o naosete mo kokoro no murazukai.
We've been listening to our live show on the theme Fault Lines for this year's Night of Ideas, a free public event gathering artists and thinkers at the San Francisco Public Library. Our guests were poet Mimi Tempest, UC Berkeley Associate Professor in Sociology Christina Mora, novelist Jonathan Escoffery, and musician Kishibashi. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
I wanted to overtake the noonday sun. Saitayo himawari ga, himawari ga, himawari ga.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.